welcome to Twig 259. We've got a full crew here today. We're going to be covering $2 billion milestones. We're going to be looking at esports and maybe a couple other surprises. With me is Philip Black, game economist at Game Economist Consulting.
A big hey today.
Eric Kress, principal at Gossamer Consulting Group.
What's happening?
Jen Donahoe, strategic marketing consultant at Beta Hat and Jade Inferno.
Howdy, everyone.
Mishka Katkov, founder of Deconstructor of Fun.
Hey, Jen keeps getting titles. I want a new title, too.
And you've got me, Laura Taranto, senior director of product at Big Fish Games.
You know, I wanted to make sure that I have my new kind of title in here, which is working with Stan at Beta Hat. And actually, Stan knows Kress really well. And he told me a story, Kress. And I wanted to see if this is maybe the softer side of Grouchy Kress. You guys went shopping. Did you find anything that made you look like a baller when you went shopping?
I bought my first Cotopaxi jacket. I don't even know how to pronounce that thing, but it's freaking dope. And I found out that Stan is a shopaholic just like me. We went out to lunch. You put in the most unflattering fucking picture of me. You can't see this, but the Stan picture is like this totally fucking shredded dude drinking a glass of water. And then this other guy is like a fat fuck, like eating a burger, right?
I don't know what. It's from Crazy Stupid Love. It's Steve Carell and Ryan Gosling at the LA Mall. Movie there at the Grove.
Embarrassing.
It's a great scene. I'll send you the clip afterwards. You got to watch this movie. No. You'll identify.
No. I try to get together with Stan at least once a month and hang out and talk about bullshit, you know, kvetch about how terrible Mishka is and stuff like that, you know. So, yeah, he's a good confidant in general. But, yeah, we hung out. Just talked about you, Jen, about how wonderful you are.
Oh,
what a great addition you are to the team. You know, it was all positive.
Well, you know, Phil had to jump in with his picture. I was just like, oh, look, it's too cute. Grown men going out shopping together in San Francisco that are both straight guys. I'm very proud of you for this behavior. This is great. This is really turning around Grouchy Kress. I love it.
Look, if I were gay, I think Stan would be on the top of the list. But nonetheless, he's a good guy.
All I can see when I look at this jacket, Kress, is you're going to fit in perfectly at GDC because you've got like basically it's a puffer vest with sleeves.
Actually, I even thought about that before I bought it because the jacket that I owned actually looks even more like a vest with sleeves. So now all these guys that are Ream and all these investment banker fucks are going to be all pissed off at me. But I promise to wear it at GDC so that everyone can show that I'm stretching my tastes in terms of clothing.
One of us.
All right, moving on.
Phil, do you have citizenship to announce?
I do. I became a Swedish citizen this week. It was awesome. Ooh. I picked up my passports. I feel 20% smugger as a European. I suddenly think 15% youth unemployment is totally acceptable. 1% real GDP growth per year. That's awesome. I think American companies aren't being fined enough.
That's all you need.
They're running the world amok. No, it's great. All that shilling to the Swedish people helped. You're stuck with me. You're stuck with me now. I'm one of you, or at least I can try to be. Also, I'm getting a Swedish tattoo. If you have any suggestions, let me know. If you know any good tattoo parlors in Södermalm, let me know. Yes, I live in Söder. There's one every 5 feet. You just trip over them. But if you got any recommendations, DM me. Not getting a dollar horse. Canelbula's out.
How about recommending not getting a tattoo?
No, I definitely want one of these. I've already decided this.
I think Phil needs to get a tattoo. I'm thinking about like something Viking stuff. Like
yes.
Yes. You feel me?
Yes.
I'm thinking about like double-edged axe and maybe those rhinestone type of a stuff. Maybe a face of a Viking warrior.
Love it.
Or text that says no FOMO.
Yes.
Not Swedish enough.
Phil is here is next week. And we'll talk about it.
This is like when dumb Americans get, you know, Japanese or Chinese tattooed on them and it says something, you know, completely opposite of what they actually mean. You're that dumb American going to Sweden and getting a Viking tattoo. Good job.
I only see a Swede. I see a Swede. I don't see American.
I would be more sympathetic to that, Jen, if you don't walk into H&M here and there isn't like UNC Chapel Hill and like Yale and Harvard sweatshirts. It's reverse Uno.
All right. Let the shilling begin.
Yeah. No. A small piece on my side. So first and foremost, next week, Phil and myself will be at Slush, 30th November, 7 p.m. in an undisclosed location. We have an event together with Makers and Arium. It's called MAD Mixer. Somebody actually suggested that it should be called MADOF. So Makers, Arium, DOF. We're going to keep it as MAD. It's probably better. Anyway, really fun event. We're going to have hundreds of founders, executives, investors. just like last year, super fun. If you don't have an invite, please do ping me and we'll see if we can get you in. I went to see the venue. There's foosball table. There's all that fun stuff. So we're going to have a good time. Second part, I wanted to give a shout out to RovioCon Google. It's a fun event during Slush on November 29th. It starts at 9 a.m. I'll be personally there. I think Phil is coming to the event. I'll be personally actually running a panel on how to grow mobile business post-ATT with Phil Hickey, CMO of Sybo. So could be fun. But I really suggest you come in early because the keynote speaker is Rina Anur. You've probably heard her on this podcast. So former founder of Peak, founder of Spike Games. So really looking forward for the event and for Rina's talk at the event. One more thing. Myself and Jen are joining panel on 28th of November, a data AI panel together with Brett Novak and Nico Vuori. So it's a data AI webinar, and we will be talking about future of gaming, all kinds of interesting stuff. It will be fully unedited. So come and join. Jen, are you looking forward to that one? There's a lot of questions that we need to answer.
Yeah, it's a live webinar, and this podcast is heavily edited because we say a bunch of stuff that later we regret. So you'll probably get to hear lots of things said that we wish were edited. So it's on November 28th, Tuesday of next week, 11 a.m. Pacific time, 7 p.m. GMT, just to make sure we get all of the time zones in there. Looking forward to that. So with Slush coming up, I was wondering if I could do a public service announcement and ask for a quick plea as we head into the industry events that are coming up and going into GDC, as we have all of these B2B companies, investors, and people with power in our industry. Can we all agree that we should no longer have any business meetings in a hotel room? Let me tell you why. As a woman, it is very uncomfortable and unsafe to be asked by a group of men to go and have a business meeting in a hotel room. It is a safety thing. It feels really awkward. Men, do you really want your daughter or your wife, like, hey, I'm traveling internationally. I was asked to go into a hotel room with a meeting with a bunch of men. Doesn't that make you feel a little bit uncomfortable? I get that we're in an industry where you need to have confidentiality. You need to get apart from people. But anywhere other than a hotel room is all that I'm asking for. Cafes, lobbies, maybe talk to the hotel, maybe get something else. Your brand and your reputation as a company will really benefit from making sure that you're being inclusive, you're thinking about safe environments for people, and there's nothing can be misconstrued about what's going on. I know that, Mishka, you said Slush, like business deals are done in saunas and on, you know, playing ice hockey. Let's try to make things a little bit more inclusive for everybody that can't participate in those things. Do you disagree with this?
I think agree. I just wanted to add a little bit of a more context and perhaps offer suggestion on how to overcome this issue. So 100%, most women feel very awkward meeting men in hotel rooms in conferences. I think that shouldn't come as a surprise to anybody. But we have to take it into account that when we're talking about big conferences like GDC, Web Summit, Slush, Gamescom, you have tens of thousands of attendees coming into a city. And they represent thousands upon thousands of companies. And yet, at the same time, these cities tend to have only tens of banquet halls. Also, these banquet halls are quite expensive because they're rare, because they're big, and that makes them inaccessible for most companies to have for meetings. So that leads us to a situation where companies are essentially forced to have meetings in hotel rooms. And the suggestion to have meetings out in coffee shops or breakfast meetings or hotel lobbies, that is definitely happening, but a lot of these meetings that are happening in the hotel rooms are private. During a big event, there's industry people all around you, and you can't really get to talk about specific business topics in an open setting. And also, sometimes there are parties meeting that you don't want to get those rumors going. And for that as well, it's important to have the place of privacy. And unfortunately, there's very limited space for privacy during these big conferences. So I would like to propose two concrete suggestions to companies that are hosting meetings in hotel rooms. So number one is have women colleagues who are present at those meetings that you're hosting. You can probably add a little bit more diversity to the group and through that make it feel more comfortable for the women who are coming to meet you in the hotel room. Now, I understand that's not always possible. Sometimes companies simply don't have women in that specific craft that is meeting, which is a different type of a problem. But oftentimes what happens is that the women are actually not present because they are doing a talk, attending another meeting, meeting another partner, and that there's a logical reason why there's not no women there. And that leads to a second point that I want to suggest is, like, before having those meetings in the hotel room, if you have an all-female group or a woman coming in for a meeting, be forthcoming and empathetic towards her. Explain the situation. Hey, we are having a meeting in a hotel room. This could make you feel uncomfortable. So suggest to her that instead of having that meeting in a hotel room, you're having a meeting with her over a coffee or in a hotel lobby or a breakfast or a lunch, as Jen, you suggested. And break down that meeting, that have the private part through a video conference, like have the call before the event, have that face-to-face time where you can form that human connection in a more open space rather than in a hotel room. And at least suggest that. It could be that the female founder, executive director will just say that it's all okay. We can have the meeting in a hotel room. I'm actually busy. I don't have time. I already have a different coffee meeting. So that's all fine. Great. Now it's her decision to move forward. But at least it's important to offer a different avenue than it's the hotel meeting or nothing. So I think it's important for us to offer these type of solutions rather than saying that companies should not be inviting women to have meetings in the hotel rooms, because whether women will come or not, they will still have those meetings during those conferences in hotel rooms and other places. And we don't want women to miss out and be disadvantaged compared to their male colleagues. So I would rather push companies to add diversity to their teams that are sitting in those hotel rooms. Be empathetic, break down your meetings where you can have the business focus meeting through a video conference in advance. And then during the conference, instead of inviting the female to the hotel room, just have that meeting in the open space. And I think you'll get more out of it and form a better human connection than inside of a hotel room. So kind of a difficult topic. So if you, the audience, have other suggestions on how to approach this challenge of having very limited space, and the fact that women are uncomfortable meeting men in hotel rooms, like, how do we solve this as an industry? Would love to hear that from you.
The problem is, in our industry, it's 75% men. Mm-hmm. And so almost all of the time, I'm the only woman in a group of people. I think that where possible, stop doing it. If it's impossible, then really try to go out of your way to make it as inclusive as possible, to have other folks there, to leave doors open. I would just really try to avoid it almost at all costs. If you can't, then just be really upfront with people about how safe you're making the situation. All right, we're going to move on to quick hits. Bunch of stuff going on. So Nuzu has lowered its games market forecast in 2023 to $184 billion. It's only a 0.6% increase year over year in its latest report. The last time that they did this, it was a 2.6% increase. So they've taken that down a little bit. They're citing challenges, obviously, in the mobile market, suggesting that a challenging privacy landscape. So they're still citing the IDFA issues as things that are limiting growth until 2026. They also talked about the potential impact of the Epic versus Google antitrust trial. I'm not sure why they would put that in without really knowing where that's going yet, but that was one of the things they talked about. So Circana, which is formerly NPD, has their October numbers out. And so I think many people know that the UK numbers are easier to see and come up more quickly. For the US numbers, it's kind of like on a monthly rollout. So thank you to Matt Piscatella for working on this. And he usually posts this on his LinkedIn page. So follow him for all of these great updates. So US consumer spending on video game content, hardware, and accessories fell 5%. Versus year ago to $4 billion. Declines were experienced across all categories of spend, but the dip was partially driven by Call of Duty shifting release months. It launched a little bit later this year versus other years. AppsFlyer says that UA budgets were down 20% in Q3 2023 compared to last year. They have their new performance index. If you haven't seen this before, it's really great. You can get to see top channels by platform, by country, by industry. So just two quick things. On iOS, they have this thing called Power Ranking, which is an indication of spend effectiveness. On iOS, app Apple search ads always comes in at number one, as you know, because Apple search ads gets all the data. So they tend to rank really high. That was followed by Liftoff, Moloco, Meta, and AppLovin. On Android, it's different. The power ranking is a little bit different. Google leads there, obviously, because they get all the data, followed by Unity, IronSource, Meta, and AppLovin. So that's the App Flyers Index. Unity partners with Roku to bring user acquisition campaigns to the big screen. So connected TVs or CTV, you'll start to hear a lot more of this, are ways that you can get better attribution when you do user acquisition. Connected TVs can now allow players to download apps direct from their mobile to an ad placed by Unity. Roku's reach is approaching half of all US broadband houses. So it's interesting that Unity has found another way to kind of establish a UA channel. And finally, from Unity, they had their big summit just a week ago. In a big branding move, they have changed the name of Unity 2023 LTS to Unity 6 ahead of its 2024 launch. So the Unity engine will get numbers denoting each one, allowing you to know which one is which version of Unity that you're running on. Kress, take it away.
The reality around what's going on at Unity is I'm hearing rumors from all kinds of different sources that a huge layoff is going to happen. Like, they're talking about like 50% of the US workforce. So I don't know. Nothing seems to be going well for them at this moment, but we'll see. So layoffs. Oh, according to videogamelayoffs.com, and this was covered by, what's his name?
Yoast.
The site, it's tracking public announcement of layoffs. It says that 8,000 people have lost their jobs in gaming in 2023. I'm going to continue to argue. While that's tragic, the reality of it is it's a very small, maybe 2 or 3% of the overall jobs out there. And I would imagine that there's more wrecks out there than 8,000 across the industry. So yes, we are going through a transition, but you have to keep in mind the context of that transition is amongst the most hiring we've ever seen in gaming for the last 3 or 4 years, particularly with some of this new stuff like Web3 stuff. So anyway, yes, we are in an adjustment period in the gaming space. Humble Games laid off valued colleagues as restructuring begins. Games from Digital Brothers Group has announced a reduced global staff by 30%. Supercell has expanded its leadership with a new head of live games and a first ever chief marketing officer. Wow, dude, that is a coup d'etat, right? Supercell doesn't believe in marketing, I thought. But anyway, so former Mojang head of games, Sarah Bach, is now head of live games. She has worked in the industry for more than 17 years. Actually, I met her a couple of times. Battlefield, Star Wars, Battlefront, and Minecraft. She also worked at King. Well, how long was she working at King?
She was there about 2 years. I think she was in a director of production capacity role. I never worked with her directly, but I remember the name when I was there.
Okay. And so the ex-King CMO, Fernanda Romano, she's joining as chief marketing officer. That's going to be a tough job, Miss Fernanda. That's going to be a really tough job. Just saying.
But kudos to Supercell. Two women in prominent leadership positions. This is why I dropped it in here for you. Just really, number one is CMO. But number two is like we're seeing a little more kind of recognition. So, you know, kudos to you guys for doing that. Look at you in the Nordics.
Or it's the sheep to the wolves, right? I mean, it's not an easy role. Let me tell you.
Yeah, no, it is not with the current state of how Supercell is working. Although, did you see too that they admitted that not having producers was wrong and now they're hiring producers for their big games? Did you see something like that?
In all simplicity, Supercell is becoming a normal gaming company. They're hiring against the normal roles, the product managers, the producers, the CMOs, the live ops operations. Like, we're asking, like, what kind of a role is this? Is this the role that every single gaming company has? Oh, wow.
But this is my point. You can hire roles all the fuck you want, but if the culture doesn't allow it and the power structure, like at Sony, is all in the studios, it doesn't matter who you hire as a CMO, right? I mean, this happens across the entire industry, not just Supercell. But, you know, this is a sign of change, so it's good for them.
Regarding the CMO, I think this is the type of a right type of a hire for Supercell because they have been very brand focused versus user acquisition focused for the probably past decade. In the beginning, they were very user acquisition focused. Then they switched more to a brand. So it kind of makes sense that they bring in a brand director who has both consumer brand experience as well as with Candy Crush that is quite brand driven. So in that sense, it feels like they are the right type of hire. Sarah, I don't know much about her history. I haven't met her. She's a very nice lady.
Also Swedish.
Also Swedish. That gives an extra point. True.
Oh my God. Make it stop.
Just like Phil.
Now it's the Swedish shill. Now I have to deal with that every goddamn week with Mr. Phil. All right. Infinity Ward opened a new studio in Austin, Texas. Go Call of Duty.
All right, let's talk about investments and M&A. So basically, this is from Invest Game and their latest Global Games Activity Report. So if you haven't subscribed to Invest Game, I think you should. It's a quick bite-sized investment news. Anyways, just summarizing the report, there was a decrease in deal-making activity, as we very well know. The capital raised by gaming companies year till date in 23 was 4 times lower than the average of 21 and 22. But 21 and 22 were crazy years, so it's kind of crazy to even reflect anything against those. Anyways, going to mergers and acquisitions. So beginning of 23, there was a noticeable decrease in M&A activity, almost 1/4 below the average amount of the previous year. So it's 1/4 today than it was in the previous years. But again, when we're comparing against the most booming years in the industry, it gives a little bit of a wrong picture. IPO window essentially closed, thanks to all the SPACs, the Embracers, the FaZe Clans. The world is done with gaming IPOs, and they are toxic for investors who got burned by a lot of these companies and these IPOs.
But to be clear, the whole market is closed IPOs, not just games. Like, it is a disaster out there. The two big IPOs that have happened have been an absolute cluster F. And yeah, it's just, there's no market for it. It's probably going to be second half of next year we start to see real IPOs.
Yes, 100% true. It's closed for IPOs, but talking especially with some of the bankers, they said that investors who were previously maybe avoiding gaming a little bit got into gaming in 21 and 22 and got burned real bad. And so it will take a little bit longer for gaming to come back to IPOs because of those. When it comes to early stage investments, pre-seed and seed rounds have remained steadfast, while Series A deals have decreased. This means that the funds focus on few winners and keep the activity with smaller investments because as a fund, you of course have to justify that you are doing something and it's good that you're putting in small bets, but it's clear that the funds are saving the money for the ones that are really having traction. And that's why we're seeing less of Series A and B investments going on. And finally, there was a significant decrease in AI-related deals. So everyone and their mother basically added AI to their pitch decks. And I think it's safe to say you can stop now because all these AI investments have been made. And when you're going and pitching to investors that you have AI, you have to be empathetic and understand that they have been hearing this pitch not only all day, this month, last month, and all the months prior. They have made their AI bets. So let's rebrand whatever you're doing. Have an AI component that is very important, but maybe not have it as the lead in because that ship has kind of sailed. Investment news with my commentary.
The games industry is experiencing unprecedented growth, with global revenues projected to reach a staggering $268 billion by 2025. But with more players than ever connecting across platforms and devices, how can your game stand out against the competition? AppsFlyer has created AppsFlyer for Games to help you unlock your players' true LTV by providing a wealth of game measurement solutions, unique industry insights, and proven best practices. Our dedicated hub is packed with innovative products, industry partnerships, and unrivaled expertise to ensure your game brand adapts and thrives. We understand that every game is unique, and AppsFlyer's data-driven insights allow us to cater to your specific needs. We know that in today's evolving landscape, staying ahead of the curve is crucial. Trust in AppsFlyer for Games to guide you through this exciting journey. We have the tools, the knowledge, and the passion to help you succeed in this ever-expanding landscape. Together, we'll conquer new worlds, both real and fantasy, break records, and create gaming experiences that leave a lasting impact. Get in touch with AppsFlyer for Games today and unleash your game's true potential. AppsFlyer for Games, supercharging the gaming landscape. This episode is brought to you by Data AI. Yes, they were called App Annie back in the day, but let's not talk about that. Let's talk about how Data AI is the first company to combine consumer and market data with the power of artificial intelligence. And Data AI does this to unlock unique consumer and market insight to accelerate competitive advantages across all digital channels worldwide. What we here at Deconstructor Fund really like is Data AI's Game IQ tool. It's this fantastic market and competitive intelligence tool for mobile gaming that allows publishers to really get to the feature level of a game without doing a full-on deconstructing first. Using this tool, your team can quickly tie features to performance KPIs, which will help you make difficult roadmap decisions. It's also a great tool to identify hidden growth opportunities as you can analyze games on a scale. As you well know, there are hundreds of thousands of gaming apps in the App Store and thousands of new mobile games released each month. And while we don't want you to stop reading and listening to Deconstructor Fun, the fact is we can't cover it all. With Data AI, and especially their Game IQ tool, you'll be able to efficiently determine what features provide a lift, make roadmap decisions based on accurately modeled expected outcomes, discover how competitors lifted performance through feature releases, benchmark performance against your competitors, focus with confidence on the highest potential genre for a new game release. We here at Deconstructor Fun are huge fans of Data AI. So what are you waiting for? Go to Data AI and try the service for free.
All right, Phil.
Buckle in. The Match 3 car customization market, yes, that's a real thing, is in a street race. Forza Customs is out worldwide. This is based on the Forza franchise. It is made by Hutch. This actually has licensed cars in it. So let's see if Space Ape is going to sweat with Chrome Valley Customs also out. This one surprised me. I didn't know this one was happening, but this solves a lot of the criticisms we had of Chrome Valley Customs. It's a lot less cartoony. The graphics look a lot more realistic. Something to keep track of. And against all odds, Rovio is developing a physics-based puzzle similar to Angry Birds Dream Blast, but this time it is not based on the birds. It is based on the Moomins characters. It's not about birds anymore. And of course, Angry Dreams Blast is Rovio's second biggest revenue earner in the last year, neck and neck with Angry Birds 2. So they're clearly trying to reskin the game, maybe add a little bit of IP pizzazz. Warcraft Rumble is up to $14 million in its first 2 weeks, according to AppMagic, but it is only at 3 million downloads in the 2 weeks following its release. It's looking a little soft. Another thing we're going to continue to keep track of is this IP able to deliver that's below and behind Diablo Immortal when it launched.
Sorry, Phil, I want to interrupt that. When I was at Riot and we were launching our games, TFT, which is League of Legends branded, so you could think of it as the first game outside of the core MOBA, God, we were at like 10 or 11 million downloads in the first month. And so when I saw 3 million downloads for Warcraft Rumble, I'm like, what is wrong? What's going on there? Doesn't that feel like extremely light? Because this was a global launch, right? Something's wrong. Although the revenue is great.
Yeah, I don't think they do UA.
They're clearly not doing UA.
Yeah.
I mean, I bet this is primarily organic and then any type of other type of marketing, but it doesn't seem like they're doing any like meaningful direct UA.
3 million organic is not a good sign either.
No, I know, but maybe they're holding off and they're building out the game a little bit more until they start doing major user acquisition. But it's a core game. You know how hard it is to scale core games these days? It's almost impossible. It's like,
no, I had an auto battler I was trying to market, but yes, it was 2020. And yes, you know, we launched right when COVID and lockdown started. So I think I know the UA guy at Blizzard. I think I'm going to give him a call and see what's going on.
There's such a thing as a UA person at Blizzard?
Yeah. There is.
Yeah, there is. There is.
And he's amazing. He's such a lovely guy.
Well, let's see if he has any budget to do UA.
I can reveal Activision pinged us. We had a deconstruction for Warcraft Rumble, and they pinged us for a quote if they can use it in their promotion. It was a nice quote. And so I think it's going to grow from now. Like once they get DOF approval quote, then it's off to the moon, right?
Speaking of off to the moon, last Thursday, Sony launched the PlayStation Portal for $200. And in Sony's words, it's a remote player. It can't run games on its own, but it can run any game that's stored on a person's PlayStation 5. The games are streamed to the Portal via Wi-Fi, unlike the Switch.
This is sold off the shelves. I had to like Google videos of people reviewing it because I could not understand how this thing worked.
Dude, I don't know. I'm Eric, telling what you, this device is meant for the corest of the core. And it's just a really nice, it's a nice piece of gear, but it's such a niche use case. You have to be on the same Wi-Fi as your PlayStation to play it. So it's like, there's no functionality besides super dorks that want every PlayStation thing that they can get. It doesn't even make sense.
The best part about this is they had this with the PSP and the Vita. They had this with the PlayStation 4. It's like they're going backwards.
Right.
And it didn't work.
This technology has existed for like two generations. I've said this before in the podcast. I've actually talked to people at Sony and literally The hardware guys have fuck all to do in between platforms, and you just need them to keep going. And they give them VR, you give them like motion control. They just need stuff to work on, right? And they do an amazing job, but there's no business case for it besides keeping them happy. I mean, this is what I've heard from a couple people. So this seems like the same type of thing. So anyway.
Scopely's Stumble Guys introduces a new in-game stumble workshop for user-generated content. This now means that Stumble Guys, Fall Guys, and Eggy Party all have in-game UGC editors. All eyes are going to be on Tencent's competitors, Yuan Mengstar, which had a premiere trailer last month. I guess this is a new genre that's heating up, the party platformer genre, but it has done a crazy amount of downloads on every iteration that's come out.
Yeah, so Activision has a press release about Modern Warfare 3. We know that the reviews have been absolutely terrible. They are seeing record levels of engagement from the trilogy. So this is like kind of the headline, right? And then you actually read a little bit further, and it basically is saying this metric is time spent per player. So a much smaller player base, but every player is spending more time than any other Modern Warfare in history or something like that. But there is some good news. I mean, that's actually good news in some sense because the most core people keep playing, so they're going to spend a lot, and so they should be okay from a revenue perspective potentially. But the zombie mode evidently is one of the drivers of that, that you can take to the bank. Because actually the zombie mode, if you've played it, it's actually really fun and much more well done than historically. So I guess despite terrible reviews, this franchise will continue forever, you know, and next year will be the hero SKU and everyone will come back. So there we go.
All right, Phil, channel your inner Ethan and tell us about Web3.
It doesn't have to just be Web3. This is going to be about MMOs too. When we were talking, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, Rocket League had removed their ability for players to trade items to one another. And one of the reasons that I thought might be the case for this is that if you have items that can be traded, what happens over time is that the items accumulate and ultimately price is driven downward. And this is something that every Web3 game deals with, or at least most Web3 games are going to deal with if they can survive that long. And it's certainly something that almost every MMO game deals with. And so the problem is that there isn't capital depreciation. So if you're playing World of Warcraft or you're playing Guild Wars or you're playing a lot of these MMOs, you're able to generate resources almost infinitely. So you go out, you slay a monster, an item drops. You go out and you slay a monster another time, another item drops. And so the supply curve continues to shift outward. And as we know, if you hold demand constant and you just continue to shift the supply curve outward, price is going to fall. And I think that's what happens in a lot of these games, is that price just falls because assets continue to move outward. So one of the ways that MMO designers have dealt with this problem is by introducing durability. So durability is the idea that every durable essentially becomes a consumable. So if you swing an axe enough, the axe won't be usable and I'll need to go to a repairsmith and I'll need to spend some amount of currency to be able to repair the axe. So what you're doing is you're creating a constant sink for your constant faucet. And if you can align those two things, you can hold price constant and you won't have hyperinflation. The problem is that they never set the tax high enough, that durability tax high enough. And so you still tend to have these hyperinflation problems. And they don't set the tax high enough is because players fucking hate durability. They hate the idea they don't truly own their items and that everything is a consumable. Now, in the real world, we have this problem too. If you have like a digital asset, if you have a Taylor Swift song, you know, it's just as good after the millionth listen as is the first one.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Bad example.
The digital file is still good. Listener quality is another topic. But in the physical world, you have this capital depreciation. So a t-shirt is going to get worse. It's going to stretch out. It's going to have stains on it. That's kind of what durability was trying to mirror. So the question is whether or not there are other solutions to this problem besides durability. So Eve, for example, had destructibility. So that's one of the ways we're going to move assets from items in circulation is we're just going to blow it up. Magic the Gathering came up with this idea of formats. So we're going to have limited and constructed. So only a certain amount of formats are relevant at any one time. So I think there's another answer here, which I've been working with some crypto clients on, which is what I call a staircase tax. And so the idea here is that we're going to maintain the item's utility. So the item itself is going to have the same power, attack, stats, whatever it may be, no matter how many times you swing that axe. But what is going to change is that there's going to be an escalating tax every time that item is traded. So what we can imagine is the first time that axe is traded on the marketplace, there's a 5% tax. The next time that item is traded, there's a 10% tax. And the tax will continue to escalate until it reaches 100%. And so the idea here is that as the tax rises, it becomes more and more of a disincentive to list that item on the marketplace. And so what's happening is that items are naturally being removed from market circulation. And what will happen is if you can set this tax at the optimal rate, then you've solved the problem of having these hyperinflation economies without having to make every item a consumable. So I think there's something to this. There is one firm out there that's done a version of this. It's actually DraftKings has an NFT product called Rainmakers, which is for football right now. And although they don't have an escalating tax on transactions, what they do have is a tax on seasons. So if you buy, let's say, 2023 NFL players and it's 2024, those 2023 NFL players will have a reduction in the amount of points they score by only scoring as much as 95 points. You only maintain 5% of last season's value. And then if it's two seasons out, I think it's something like 1% of the value. So I don't know. I think there's something to this design. There's a huge optimization box. You can optimize whether or not you sent this tax at an individual item level, whether or not you set it at a global category. What is the rate of the tax? Is it 5% that it increases by? Is it a linear curve? Is it an exponential curve? Is it a bonding curve? You can do a million things with this, but I think there's something to using this solution rather than having to design your way into destructibility or a season format or something of the like.
Phil, I don't know if you listened to the last episode I had on Web3 with Warren Woodward, and he had an interesting kind of like a 4-point reason for the whole demise of Web3, and I'm curious to get your opinion on that since we are in the Web3 topic, haven't been here for a long time. So the way he kind of described why the Web3 bubble burst was the crypto market crash, leading to a downturn in the games market with layoffs and panic. The second one was the play to earn, once considered a promising concept, shout out to Axie Infinity, was deemed a failed hypothesis, although it was incorrectly associated with Web3 gaming tech. The third reason was that many crypto tourists left the scene due to rug pulling and token devaluation, and VC funding for crypto projects has dried up. And then the fourth one was the in-game token model insisted upon crypto VCs, which crypto VCs insisted on, had a 100% fail rate, prompting a call to find product market fit and causing panic among unprofitable companies. So meaning fail rate that once they would invest, they would get tokens, and once the project goes live or there's a certain valuation that increases with the token price, they would simply dump the token. And of course, that floods the market and they get their money back and more. And then the project is valued because there's so much surplus of tokens in the market.
I don't think any of those points are wrong. They all seem reasonable, but I would put a big fat fucking reason ahead of all of that, which is they can't ship a fucking product that anyone cares about. That's your problem. Like, that's the problem. Can anyone tell a crypto game that they care about? Like, is there anything that anyone feels like they're missing out on something by not being involved in crypto?
Shrapnel.
No, hasn't released.
Shrapnel hasn't released.
It's an extraction shooter.
It's a rare, whatever. They're doing a good job in terms of catering to that audience. That's the only one that you can really point to.
That's all you got. That's it. You got one product. And to Eric's point, that's the one that survived in terms of price durability, even during the crypto downturn. So, I mean, that's it. Ship a fucking product anyone cares about. And then we can talk about the four problems that are laid out here. But if you can't ship interesting products, no one cares about all this baggage. It's not that complicated in my view.
I listened to both podcasts, the Deconstructor Fun one, which I thought was the most reasonable analysis of the Web3 industry that I've heard since I started covering, after talking to Nico and all these other guys about this nonsense, right? And I do recommend listening to it because I think he's just a very pragmatic type view of where we are and where we're headed and where the possibilities may lie, right? But on the other hand, I listened to the Navik podcast and I wanted to shoot myself. Like, these guys are living under a rock. Like, what is happening with them? These guys were the pioneers of this stuff. They know better than to spout this stuff. Like, no, we're not in some renaissance of Web3 at all. Like, there's one game that is successful, and even they're having challenges that they need to overcome, right? I mean, they're out of their collective minds, right, on this current state of the industry. In my view, this is a technology. It's not an industry, right? To Phil's point, we're waiting for a game that successfully introduces ownership and trading and solves all these issues around that, with a really solid game loop that people care about, right? And my point has always been, this is a feature that no one really wanted for the last 30 years that existed with existing technology, you know, trading and all this other stuff. So I think building a game with a lot of economic balance is going to be really hard. And clearly making a game that people care about is going to be really a challenge. So that's why I was going to bring up Sorare or whatever. They're doing a really good job with these sports games. But the ironic truth is that these exchanges have existed for decades, right? Maybe not decades, I'm exaggerating. But FIFA, NBA, Madden, there have been trading mechanisms within that game that actually trade players. But you're, in essence, you're building a better, more core mousetrap for this audience that is so engaged with these leagues and these players that they're willing to do these trades and they're trying to build systems around that. And I think that is probably what they're achieving on. So what is not clear to me is that what other games are going to fit this mold, right? Shooters, RPGs, like the traditional genres, like where are we going to find, you know, overlap and fit for these type of technologies? That's super unclear. And certainly, what your shrapnel is building the shooter, the extraction type shooter, like, is that really something that people want to be doing? Trading items around and, I don't know, maps. There's like all kinds of features that they're talking about that I don't even know if it exists at this point. So
it's the cart before the horse. It's like everyone's trying to find out some unique case for the blockchain. I'm like, ship a fucking product someone cares about. Whether or not it uses the blockchain in an interesting way, I mean, that's great. But just do something interesting. Do anything that gets eyeballs that makes a compelling product. How did Steam launch when it came out?
Oh, it was Half-Life 2.
Exactly. What brings people to platforms is compelling exclusive content. Get some compelling exclusive content.
But it's not a platform. That's the problem, though. It's not a platform. It's a tech. Again, my point is that we've had this technology, the capability of building exchanges and trading and all this stuff. No one designed anything for it that was really meaningful except for the MMOs, right? Anyway, I think this is technology is really trying to solve something that is not a problem. So they got the work ahead of them. But yeah, definitely listen to the Deconstructor Fun podcast about it. That was really good.
Yeah. Shout out to the podcast that you are currently listening to. That's so anyways, moving on from one to winter to another winter. So esports, let's talk about that. And the article is from Decrypt. That I think that's a crypto site. It's called Inside the Esports Industry's War for Survival. So esports bubble is finally bursting. FaZe Clan SPAC'd under $725 million valuation. And it sold recently for $16 million, so that's 97.5% drop inside a very short amount of time. Team SoloMed had their $210 million FTX sponsorship kind of die as SBF got, you know, busy with other stuff. And then now defunct Overwatch League, which Chris gleefully talked about, could cost Activision $120 million in losses. So the article covers in four different issues that it sees with esports. The first one is it is unprofitable. The article says it never made money to cover costs. They had a lot of eyeballs, lots of high-cost production, and they interviewed former evil geniuses. By the way, all these esports companies have amazing names. So Evil Geniuses CEO, he told Decrypt in an interview, by the way, he left as a CEO in 2017. Anyways, we were one of the most successful esports organizations out there, one of the biggest names, but our revenue was close to zero. That's a bummer. Number two was stupid money. So basically, investors invested into business that had no revenue. They had money to grow the business while having a broken business model, and they grew without having these strong foundation on. And then Peter continued in this interview saying, all the venture capital, money-hungry capitalists in the business world had the big eyes, quoting, and they're like, oh my God, we have to get into that. And they did, and they spent too much money in the industry. You got the FOMO realm of investing with no clear business model. So this kind of created the pressure for esports company to create as much excitement as possible to attract the investor dollars, which then led to this model of freebies for fans, which only worsened the profitability problem and the revenue problem because they're giving stuff for free. And with VCs, there was a pressure for growing rather than fixing the business model or driving revenue. That led to bloated organizations with hundreds of people and six-figure player salaries. And of course, because this is on Decrypt article, they were all then chasing crypto money because crypto was paying them so much. And essentially that was a great platform to advertise because you're getting a bunch of young dudes who like video games and you can show them all kinds of ads. And apparently they believed in Anyways, issue number 3 was player longevity. So the Washington Post actually documented on perceived ageism in esports, noting that 23 years old is a common age for players to actually retire. And that created, you know, challenges to create the sort of fandom around players. And so that's why probably they branded their esports organization so well. So instead of following the players, you're following the organizations. And finally, this is my personal reason. So actually the article covered 3, I'll cover the 4th one. I found these events very fun, going through different kind of events. The atmosphere was great, but it was extremely difficult to follow, even when they were playing games that I was playing. The live streams were incredibly long. It's like they've never heard about, you know, sports production. It's like, think about if NFL games would last 9 hours. It's quite the commitment. And they were very much designed for absolute hardcore fans. So even if you understood the game, it's very hard to follow what's actually happening there. Shoutcasters are great, but it's still very difficult. And so that makes it ultimately very hard for betting, because the user base is very young and they, you know, can't place bets. So that kind of eats away. Anyway, my conclusion of the article. So it feels like a Kotaku article in a way. It's very hyperbolic if you read it. And it paints a very one-sided picture. Like, I understand esports is tough, but saying that esports company had zero revenue based on one source is, you know, factually not true. A lot of them had revenue. It just wasn't enough to grow those type of big organizations and be profitable. And it feels like the reporter was very focused to get the quotes to paint the picture that they wanted to paint, which was incredibly negative towards esports. I'm not saying that esports is great, but it's not as negative as the report, in my opinion, makes it. So esports is not utter garbage, like this article says. It's a great engagement channel for super successful games, and it's not a growth channel. And I think that's where the mistake with a lot of companies came, when they thought that they would be acquiring users. I think this is a re-engagement channel. I think this is catering to your hardcore fans. And then esports team are also not running on pure VC money. For example, I went to some of the numbers, like Cloud9, their annual revenue is 4.3 million. That's not a lot, but it doesn't say that they're not making any money. And the ZPS data science team found that the following key financial metrics about Cloud9 after extensive research analysts said that they have 90 employees and the revenue per employee ratio is 86,000. So it's not as terribly low as the article paints. The question is, are they worth the hype? No, it's not going to replace the real sports anytime soon. And the growth numbers haven't been as high as the investors sought after. And with the free money days being over, with the interest rates being higher, investors simply won't backstop unprofitable businesses. And that's why we're seeing a lot of deaths in esports and a lot of shrinking. So I fully agree on one point in this article, and that is that VC investors are quite often blinded by the hype and FOMO. So that's my take. Chris?
This is like right when we started the podcast, one of my first calls was someone at Riot, and relatively senior. And he basically said to me that, yeah, Riot didn't make any money. They actually lost money on all their esports event. And I'm like, really? And he goes, like, it was primarily viewed as a marketing expense to re-engage the audience and get them spending in game. So in essence, they did increase their revenue, but it wasn't directly through the event itself, and that the events were all unprofitable. Because at the time, they were the most successful esports company in the world, right? They had tons of viewers and interest in their esports. So at that point, I knew this whole industry was doomed when something like it was at scale, was not profitable, and with the biggest game in the world. I mean, that's the only data point I really know. And then I started asking around. And the fundamental problem with esports is there's too many people with their finger in the till, right? So publishers, event managers, locations, teams, players, promoters, you know, the list goes on and on, you know, about who's trying to make money out of these events. And the only way you can actually pay for all these constituents is with TV advertising. And so it was all kind of resting on the fact whether they can grow viewership to justify major TV advertising. And the audience just never got to scale enough to create that opportunity, even though they were on ESPN and all other events. And I'm sure people will argue differently about, you know, the potentials. The worst part is that when they really tried to make a big go out of it at Blizzard, is they went after Overwatch, was arguably the worst fucking esports ever, right? Like, it's impossible to follow, impossible to watch for an extended period of time. And that was their big test case. And they spent gajillions of dollars. And in their defense, they created a great goddamn esport, right? They created the great facilities. They created great teams. They did everything they could to build the most amazing esports league that you could possibly make, but it was the wrong fucking game, you know, fundamentally, right? Anyway, even with the right game, I don't know if that would be successful. So I always thought esports was kind of doomed from the get-go. I think, you know, Riot will continue to do what they do with League of Legends, but I just never really thought that it would be, you know, a meaningful contributor to revenue growth for any of these publishers. It just didn't make sense from the very get-go, particularly with Riot. If they can't make money on it, nobody could, you know? So, Jen?
Crush, you're so right. Even the best in the business and the biggest esports game in the world, Riot's League of Legends, constantly struggles to make money, especially in the US. Players really love it, but the economics just aren't there, and very, 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 very few games can get the numbers that would have a chance of mattering. However, there were some positives coming out of this year's Worlds, which is the pinnacle of League of Legends esports. So LoL Worlds 2023 Finals broke the all-time esports event viewership record with almost 6 million concurrent viewers, even excluding China viewership. And I think many of us know that the China viewership is probably matching that, if not exceeding that 6 million number just itself for that country. China is the largest country for League of Legends. Korea coming in number two. I'm sure most people kind of know this about the power of that game and that brand. So on the flip side, though, Riot Games and the LCS announced on November 20th, 2023, that both the Golden Guardians and the Evil Geniuses were exiting the league. The North America League of Legends competition will only feature 8 teams for the 2024 season, and all of the staff and players of those 2 teams will be released from their contracts. So again, even though their success at a global level, at a high level, in some countries, especially in the US, it's tough to keep that league going, so to speak, and to turn that profitable. They do a lot of profitability with sponsorships, and there are a lot of ways and income streams that do make sense. But, Chris, to your point, there are too many people putting their hands in the cookie jar and pulling out cookies for everyone to make enough money in this. So maybe there's something in the middle. When I was on TFT, we did a lot of grassroots or local programs, and that was where we were seeing a lot of great interest. It wasn't as expensive to run those competitions. Players really loved it. A lot of the local marketing teams were able to run that more profitably. So I think there's something to be said for smaller grassroots opportunities. But yeah, on the big stage, esports is just struggling right now to find a way to get to profitability.
Hey, game devs. Are you tired of dealing with complicated payment processes all over the world? Well, Xsolla's got your back with Xsolla PayStation. It has a simple, user-friendly interface that makes it easy for players to pay for your games and in-game content however they want. And because the Xsolla PayStation user interface is adaptive and accessible on smartphones, tablets, and PCs, your players will have a seamless experience no matter their preferred device. Players can save their favorite payment methods for future purchases, and on mobile, even charge purchases directly to their phone carrier bill. On the back end, you can customize your checkout with game-specific integration options like sidebars and iframes, as well as change colors, fonts, and images to make PayStation look and feel like a natural part of your game. Ready to see Xsolla's PayStation in action? Visit xsolla.pro/payments-dof or visit the link in this podcast description. I wanted to talk to you about Heroic Labs. Building a successful game is hard enough without worrying about building your own game tech as well. Heroic Labs provides a comprehensive game stack to help you get your game into market faster and scale beyond the competition. With their Unity game framework Hero, you can cut development and prototyping time in half and quickly add social, economy, and reward systems to grow your game. Satori, the LiveOps platform built specifically for the games industry, lets you run live events, A/B tests, deliver dynamic content to players, and always keep your game growing. Nakama, the industry's leading open source game server, lets you develop locally, providing all social and competitive features for your game, and then seamlessly transition to their Heroic Cloud hosted service and easily scale to meet the largest of audience demands. Find out how to get started at heroiclabs.com.
Monopoly Go has passed $1 billion, $1 billion with a B, in revenue, and has 100 million downloads since April. It is recognized as the fastest casual game to reach $1 billion with 200 million in monthly earnings. Wow. Wow, 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 wow.
I think, Phil, you were saying that we should take a victory lap, and I have to be true to the standards of integrity of Twig that I was partially right, but also partially wrong in one of the previous episodes. My bet after playing it was that this was going to be the biggest casual game in Scopely's portfolio, but I wasn't sure at that time if it would pass Coin Master in revenue. And it just did, looking at data AI, looking actually at the charts. It's hard to tell just out of this, but I would even argue that they're taking a little bit of share from Coin Master. It's not fully incremental. Yeah. They're taking players and payers away.
Unbelievable success for Scopely. And I know there are three former Scopely employees on this podcast. And to me, like, this is the hit that has always eluded Scopely and I think is everything that they've wanted to be. You know, one of the PMs I worked with at Scopely back in the day used to say that we took C games at Scopely and we live ops them to be B+. And that was something I think a lot of game designers and product managers would agree with. And it's not an insult. It's just kind of the way things were. And this is the game that I think finally combines all of Scopely's strengths and also their learnings. And I think one of the most powerful things about Walter, Javier, and Tim, and to me that is the trio there, is their ability to learn over time and their ability to learn from mistakes. And one of the criticisms that was made a lot at Scopely is that they didn't have enough creative focus. They were taking C games and they were live opsing to BP+. Their entire org structure is based on product managers. Directors of product are the center of the world for all of these games. And Monopoly Go was the first time they really pivoted away from that. They hired Massimo, who was someone from Zynga, who was a very creative focused person, and he was put in a very senior leadership position. And not only that, they stuck with this game for a very long time. Scopely didn't have a lot of tolerance for product failures. They were known to cut people loose if things didn't succeed in a relatively short time span. And this game started as a Clash Royale type sync PvP game. And they made huge changes to this game, including a studio change over a long period of time. And they stuck with it. And ultimately, their faith was rewarded. And not only was their faith rewarded with, I would say, an innovative design, but they also were able to play on Scopely's strengths on the live ops side and on the marketing side as well. Like, they have the IP that they got from Hasbro, which is them building their relationship. Remember Yahtzee, the dice franchise that no one seems to talk about, has done over $500 million in lifetime revenue. So they're able to combine that with their marketing machine, their UA machine, their understanding of not only UA, but also brand marketing. That is the one thing that Scopely always got right, was brand marketing was always really key. They understood the role of IP and its relationship to CPIs. That's just like a beautiful fit for this company. It is the hit that's always eluded them. They've always wanted something of this scale. They always felt they deserved it. They've been playing this for a really long time. They should take a huge victory lap. I am curious, Eric, whether or not you think they sold too quickly and whether or not they should have held on to this one and whether or not this is basically their enterprise value now. But this is a huge success, a huge trophy, I would say, for Javier, Walter, and Tim, and I think they really deserve it.
To put it in perspective, my understanding is that they actually had this Monopoly license in 2015. It's been a long time coming, and I've already admitted once, but I will admit again that they did not overpay. Savvy did not overpay for this, given the success of Monopoly Go. It is clear that part of the valuation was contingent on the success of this game, most likely, but it's hard to say. Did they sell too early? I think, actually, even with the success, this environment's going to be really rough to get acquisitions, but anyway, I think they did a good job of managing shareholder value, Javier and Walter. And yeah, this game is just an absolute monster. And honestly, you know, when we start talking about looking at year in reviews and talking about the game space, the big thing that comes out is that this game basically saved the entire industry from another negative year. So like, without this game, the market would have been down. And I know you can't really do that, I understand. But what I'm saying is that the amount of money they spent on marketing, the amount of success this game has done, is really kind of bolstered the entire industry, particularly casino games, which I actually would not put this in the casino games. I'm gonna have to talk to them about that yet. But neither would I do for Coin Master. So good on them.
So I second and third the kudos to the Scopely team, just aligning with you guys. So much great stuff here. Forgive me, I'm gonna do some retelling and some stories I may have told in the past, but I wanted to pull together as much as I could about why I have seen a thing or two with Monopoly over the past 25 years. So get ready for a ride in the Wayback Machine. Sorry, just hold on for a second. So originally, back in the late 90s, my very first job was making Star Wars toys. And so I got to work on Star Wars Monopoly at Hasbro in the late 90s. And then I moved to Disney and I was doing Disney licensing and I was on the team that did the first Disney Monopoly game. So that pulled together Disney characters and Pixar characters for the first time ever. It was actually a big licensing feat at the time. And that was in the early 2000s. Many of you know I wanted to get into video games, and I was able to do that because Hasbro and EA did a deal. And so in 2007, I was able to do Monopoly and all of these other games when I landed at EA. And in fact, I actually have a IRL Monopoly with the EA brands on a Monopoly board that we got from Hasbro when we signed that the actual deal. I think there's only 30 in existence. I'll post a picture because it's pretty cool to see some of the OG, like Medal of Honor spaces on the board on that board game. So when I'm thinking about that, I've made Monopoly probably 10 or 15 SKUs across all platforms, console, PC, even mobile, even the iPod with the click wheel. I think we even did one of those back in the day. So then Monopoly actually stalked me to Scopely, where I was the marketing person on Monopoly Go version 1 in 2017, 2018. So if you do the math, this game has been baking at Scopely for 5+ years. And so, Phil, I can definitely confirm that it was based on Clash Royale. And I also had the benefit of working with Massimo and Jaime, who were both on Farmville at Zynga when I was there. And then they came over to Scopely to work on this game. Great, great guys. And for sure, key to success and where this was going. All this to say that Mr. Monopoly and I have seen some shit. So let's cut to the chase on why this all worked. By the way, Mr. Monopoly's name is Milburn Pennybags. We'll do a quiz later and see if you remember. Not actually Mr. Monopoly, but everyone, you know, tends to call him that. Or Rich Uncle Pennybags is the other one that people call him. Okay, so here we go. Here's the Monopoly magic formula. A bunch of things in here. Number one is going back to what you guys just said, that strong creative team that knows how to find the fun, deliver on the feeling of the brand, the core fantasy, for the core audience, and then live ops the shit out of it. Even though this isn't true Monopoly, it gives you the feeling of wealth. It gives you the feeling of the zero-sum game of being, you know, the one to bankrupt your friends. It is a screw-your-friend kind of game, and they found a lot of that fun in the way that the game came to life. So number two is someone to copy, a killer social casino game that pioneered asynchronous multiplayer, ripe for copying. This is Coin Master, guys. It's a page right out of the OG Zynga playbook. Is if there wasn't a Coin Master, I'm not sure this version of Monopoly Go would be what it is. And that's okay, you know, as long as we copy and innovate, to Phil's point of 80% copying, 20% innovation, I think they've done a lot of that in this case. So a patient licensor is number three. So Hasbro was really willing to let this game bake, go for the grand slam, and be patient, put the creative keys into the hands of a really talented team. So also think about what Mattel did on Barbie. They had that same strategy of like, here you go, Greta, let's make Barbie something amazing. And that honestly is why video game properties are becoming number one successful within our own genres, but also into mass media and transmedia. Experts in their own categories are reinventing the brand for them and their consumers. And this is just something people need to learn. Okay, number four, both a global and a local brand. So Monopoly has pretty much 100% brand awareness globally. But what's interesting is everyone thinks that Monopoly came from their own country. So when you think about the board, you think about Boardwalk or Park Place, that's the American board. But in the UK, one of those spots is Mayfair, I think.
It's Mayfair, yeah.
So I don't even know all the other spots because every country has the board is based on their own country and their own kind of popular landmarks. So this really plays into the next point about global local marketing, which was a huge, huge key to their success. The marketing team and the creative team, they are the unsung heroes of this project. Yes, the game is great, but if they didn't market the crap out of this, it wouldn't be to where it is. So first, let's talk about their soft launch strategy, which is something to really learn from. If you look into Data AI, you can see that they launched in France. Not only did they launch in France, they scaled in France. So they made sure to know that the ROAS was there, the retention that was there, the performance was there before they hit the go button or pass go to collect $200 to launch globally, which is exactly what they did. You can see it, you know, right in there. Brilliant strategy, making sure that you know that you can scale before you go global. So the other piece on this global local marketing is, again, on the creative side. So all of the creative, thousands and thousands of pieces of creative are all localized for their countries. They use the board that is local to the country. They are culturalized correctly. And no one ever thanks the team for doing all of this. No one thanks the poor production person who's managing 5,000 assets a month. but I will. Good job, guys. You guys are crucial to the success of this game. Good job, Scopely Barcelona. I think creative is still done there. You guys crushed it. You hit the grand slam. This is really the marketing win of the year, I think, is just the ability to pump out all of this creative to support the last point that I have, which is a ROAS-fueled growth. They are spending reportedly $1 million a day on UA, and all of that is profitable. Having been there, we all know Scopely will not spend money on UA, but it's not done profitably. So they have been profitable from the beginning, back at that France soft launch. They knew that this was happening. So you've got positive ROAS, plus retention, plus virality, plus a revenge social mechanic. Let me talk about that in 1 second. But when you think about, you've got to have that creative to fuel that ROAS growth. And that's the formula that's really come together. So the final piece that's interesting from a gameplay perspective that I think we need to learn from, especially as you look at these social mechanics that are really winning, this asynchronous gameplay, it's the revenge mechanic. This is nothing necessarily new. It was born in the build and battle games that you have, and you really see it come to fruition in Coin Master, even in those Spice Girls commercials for Coin Masters. It's really funny, the back and forth that they have of, you killed my base. No, you killed my base. And it's the back and forth. It is absolutely the virtuous cycle of going back and forth, build and rebuild, has really made this come to light in such a positive way for Monopoly Go. And they also added some positive elements. You go in, you see your community chest, it's all your friends. So there's actually a positive benefit for your friends being there, not just a revenge mechanic of going after your friends. Hopefully that's a really comprehensive list. I probably forgot something and someone, but lots there to really give them a lot of success on this. Happy for all of those guys. Great job. On to another game with a $1 billion paycheck.
Wait, the only thing I would say is that, like, can you really say that they replicated the core fantasy of Monopoly? Like, is this really a Monopoly game? Or is this just a casino game? Like a
this is not a casino game.
Slots game.
No, I don't think this is a casino or slots game. So there's a couple things. It took a lot of inspiration from Coin Master, but there's some fundamental differences that I feel like they didn't just be like, okay, we're going to take Coin Master, put Monopoly Go art on it and call it a hit. I think they actually adapted it to what you expect for Monopoly. And I mean, Jen, you know this, when you do IP, there's a certain expectation to players that like or understand the franchise that you have to meet. And I think they did a great job adapting the board. There is lots of chance. I mean, you're rolling die. But I would not call this, it does not feel like a slot machine mechanic. It might be elements of it in terms of the randomness you're getting. But to me, this would not resonate with someone who plays slot machines or social casino games rather. And they would say, this is exactly what I want from my social casino experience. I would say that is different.
Are you just arguing about the lipstick of the game though? Where's the element of skill? Where's the agency in this game? I mean, I might concede on the lipstick stuff, but show me the agency.
I'd have to go back and play. I think the skill comes in the elements of choice and the perceived elements of choice.
Because this to me looks like a slots game.
I don't think this is a slots game.
Absolutely. This is a social casino, for sure.
Fine.
I think it's a build and battle game. It's a build and battle with a slot mechanic. It's a typical, I mean, without the intricacy of the RTS battle element of like Clash of Clans, but when I play it, you get the same type of emotion. People come in and raid your place and you're like, God damn it, I need to go back and raid them. And instead of like dropping troops, you're just playing slots and trying to find where they keep their treasure and just bomb it. That's the loop, build, battle. Yeah.
No, I completely agree with you. I think the other thing that they give you the feeling of wealth. I mean, those money animations are great. It's great to see all that money flashing around. They always make you feel like you're getting dice. You get these highs, especially when you multiply your rolls up to 100x, you know, 50x. Like that feeling of wealth and that roller coaster is really compelling. And they add these meta progression elements around moving from board to board, which I'd also love to see, you know, per the experimentation group, you know, what feature do you remove has the biggest resulting drop in KPIs? That's the heart of this game. And I think the boards play a really strong role in that. But to me, that core feeling of the dice rolling and how they integrate live ops into those dice rolls, like it's really their energy mechanic and they've figured out how to make their energy mechanic fucking compelling to spend energy in this game.
Yeah. I wanted to end it up on a little bit of a zoom out because we talked a lot about this game and how awesome Scopely is. And Chris said that this game essentially kept mobile gaming afloat. So year over year for Scopely, the revenues when comparing Q3 of this year and Q3 of 2022 grew up 161% since basically Monopoly launched. And also there's another game that Scopely that is, you know, hitting it rich in Scopely's portfolio, and that's Stumble Guys. Under Scopely, it has grown 143% since becoming part of this portfolio in Q3. And I didn't put in direct numbers because there's been reports of Scopely Webshop revenues. I think they're working with Ixola, and they also have games with extensive ad revenue. So I put in just percentages in terms of growth, but these two games are truly seeing pretty great performance under Scopely. But if you take these two games out, both Stumble Guys and Monopoly Go, the rest of the portfolio is actually not doing that great. So Star Trek Fleet Command down 45% in in-app purchase revenues year over year. Of course, web purchase revenue might be offsetting some, but there has to be decline. I bet 50% of the users didn't move to webshop. Marvel Strike Force down 53%. And what's interesting, the downloads were up 53%. So that's a double whammy. Then we see Yahtzee with Buddies. These are the top five games. Down 10%. Downloads were pretty much the same. Solitaire Peaks down 23%. Downloads were down also 26%. And Bingo Bash, so these are the GSN games, down 20%. Downloads down 30%. So my takeaways. Scopely's grit is unrivaled in the industry. This is not the first project that they work till every single stone is unturned. Breaking Bad, right, Phil?
Hey, rest in peace. Don't talk about Breaking Bad like that.
Exactly. Great show. Not that great of a game, but great show. I'm just kidding. Try to get your Swedish humor up a little bit. And what's really cool about Scopely is that it just doesn't kill these projects. It keeps on going, like with Monopoly. Since 2005, you said they had the IP. They switched the studios. They try to crack the code to put in as much efforts until they just don't have anything anymore. Either it chips and it becomes a huge hit, or they close it after doing everything possible and impossible to make it work. Scopely is clearly fantastic at launching, scaling, and running games, but they are facing the exact same headwinds of other mobile publishers with their legacy portfolio declining. I would say their core competence, what makes them truly unique, is the IP integration, and they've been doing this for a decade at least. And this is something that other publishers are only now getting into. They're talking to IP holders. They're putting different IP events. Scopely has been doing this for over 10 years, and this is very, very unique, and they're masters at it. They're based out of LA as well, where most of the top IPs are at. And the new games are vital for your business. In case of Scopely, they can build them, but they can also buy them. So I wanted to give a shout out to Rob Rickov. He's head of Scopely's Corp Dev. We talk a lot about Monopoly Go, but Stumble Guys doing extremely well.
To be clear, though, Stumble Guys is tiny compared to Monopoly Go. It's not even the same ballpark, right?
It's their second largest game in their portfolio.
It's all ads. You can't see it right now. It's a lot of ads. Remember, it started as hyper-casual.
All right. But it's not like a meaningful contributor the way Monopoly Go is.
Of course. It's much smaller, but
that's their business. Dude, you have to understand, I didn't know it was this bad, actually. I'm actually a little bit shocked at how bad it is. But the Marvel Strike Force was doing $20 million a month. It's doing like five or six now. Like, they've grown this thing to a dramatic way.
Yeah.
But that doesn't offset 75% declines. That's crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, I wanted to give a final shout out, and that is to Savvy Games Group. They paid $4.9 billion for Scopely. I think this was definitely before Monopoly Go launched. It was, I think, before they acquired Stumble Guys. So Savvy Games rolled the dice, if you will, and it was successful in this one.
All right. Thanks, everyone. See y'all next week.
Later, Skater.
Later.
You did it. You made it to the end of the episode. As a fan of the show, it would help us out if you subscribe and leave us a review on the podcast service of your choice. More importantly, are you a member of the Deconstructor of Fun Slack group? If you have 5 years or more of games industry experience, go to deconstructorofun.com/slack and apply to join. Join the games industry's best professional community, filled with peers always willing to lend a hand. Or subscribe to our newsletter to get all the latest insights from the Deconstructor of Fun content creators. Thanks for listening.